You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon, everyone. Filling in for Tom Hartman today, I am Carl Frisch. You remember me, right? We want to hear from you. Give us a call, toll-free 866-TOM. That's 866-8466, which isn't even a complete phone number. But we'll get that number straightened out for you in no time. If you want to connect with us, you can do so on Twitter, Tom_Hartman. You can follow me on Twitter, at Carl Frisch. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. You can also follow me online at carlfrisch.com, bullfightstrategies.com. You may remember me from Media Matters. I'm now at Bullfight Strategies, which is a consulting shop here in Washington, D.C. that focuses on strategy and communications practices. And I am joined in this first part of the show by my business partner, Eric Burns. Eric, good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
So, you know, I'd be remiss if we didn't keep talking about the Supreme Court, at least in some way. You've got all these right-wing politicians out there. First, you've got more than a dozen Republican governors saying that they're not going to implement, Obamacare, which is great if you're, insurance company in those states. But if you're a poor person, well, you better hightail it to a blue state. But at the same time, you've got this congressional leadership in Washington, whether it's Mitch McConnell, Eric Cantor, scheduling a vote on repealing Obamacare, now saying that they want to use reconciliation. What do you make of this mess in Washington over this?
Look, I think the Republicans have been handed a really serious defeat, and they're clearly scrambling, and I think it's going to be a really serious miscalculation for them to pin this entire election on this notion that Americans really are going to see this as a tax increase when we're talking about people having access to see a doctor.
Well, and that's the thing that I found crazy. I mean, you've got all these Republicans, they heard the word tax, and it's like a Pavlov's dog kind of reaction where they just all jumped up in the air and said, oh, it's a tax!
Yes.
That's a tax! No, it's a tax! if they take even a moment to think about what they're saying, they're basically saying that Mitt Romney raised taxes too. Because, you know, in Massachusetts, they have the individual mandate, which Mitt Romney said was for two reasons: to impose personal responsibility and to reduce costs. Same reason that Obama included it in his healthcare reform initiatives. So if Obama's raising taxes, then Mitt Romney already has raised taxes.
Well, and on this they agree, you know, so...
Right.
They don't.
That's the interesting thing. Reince Priebus was on, one of the Sunday shows saying that this is a tax increase. Meanwhile, one of the Romney spokespeople, Eric Fernstrom, said it was a penalty. It wasn't a tax increase. Let's be frank, it only affects 2% or so of the population. Those are people who will not go out and buy health insurance for themselves if they don't already have it. It doesn't affect the poor because they'll qualify into the programs that are subsidized. So it only affects the 2% of the people that want to live as, deadbeats, so to speak, not doing this and basically living on bar dime.
And the penalty that they're referring to is minuscule compared to the actual tax increases that, say Ronald Reagan instituted in 1982.
Are you speaking about his first tax increase or his second, his third? Maybe you're talking about his 11th.
I lost count, Carl, actually.
I think he lost count, too.
But, it's disingenuous. You know, the House wasting time and the Senate passing bills that they know are not going to go anywhere. It's vanity legislation, designed to force people to take bad political votes. That's a waste of money. And I think we're seeing the congressional leadership of the Republicans waste an enormous amount. I mean, they don't know where they're trying to go. Mitch McConnell's had 3 years to come up with an actual plan of what he's going to do, to ensure 30 million Americans if he repeals Obamacare, and he can't talk, he can't articulate it.
Well, they seem to have come up with a way to repeal healthcare reform in this country on the right, and it's ballsy if nothing else. Let's hit clip 16 with Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader.
The Chief Justice said it's a tax. Taxes are clearly what we call reconcilable. That's the kind of measure that can be pursued with 51 votes in the Senate, and if I'm the leader of the majority next year, I commit to the American people that the repeal of Obamacare will be job one.
So there you have Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who said not a week after President Obama was sworn into office, that his number one priority was to make the president a one-term office holder, yeah. saying that his job as majority leader with a Republican president will be to pass the repeal of health care reform through reconciliation, which is Latin for forcing it through the Senate with just 51 votes. That means skipping the ability to filibuster, my friends.
That's right.
Eric, we worked on the Rules Committee together. We saw this kind of tactics from the right all the time.
Yes.
Where Republicans would bend and twist the rules to get whatever they wanted. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's incredibly hypocritical because the Republicans were terribly afraid, and we spent a year, you know, debating that whether or not that health care was going to be passed under reconciliation.
Right.
So for them to come out now and use it is the kind of typical hypocrisy we see from the right.
They
have a long and storied history of midnight committee rule meetings, changing bills, coming out of committee before they go on the floor, and it's really destructive to our legislative institutions. But that's fine for them. And I think what's really sad is that there's anybody left in America that actually believes these clowns after the last 2 years.
Unfortunately, I suffer from a childhood fear of clowns. Well, it appears that upwards of 40% of the country has a clown fetish, despite the disastrous effects it has on their personal lives.
If only people were as afraid of Republicans as they were of clowns, then we might actually get something done in this country.
If I was as afraid of Republicans as I was of clowns, I don't think I could live in Washington, D.C. But we've got a call. Let's talk to Sean in Dover, Delaware. Hey, Sean.
Hello?
Yes. Hey, Sean.
Hey, I just wanted to comment on this Republican buzzword that they keep throwing around now, the patient-centered health care plan or whatever. And I'm just going to say that the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as they want to call it, that is patient-centered, so I don't know what they're arguing for. They've got a patient-centered plan on the books right now.
Sean, you're making the miscalculation that Republicans mean what they say. Which, you know, if there was one rule to their firm of Fight Club, it's not don't talk about Fight Club. It's, to forget what you said 5 minutes before, after saying it.
I can just jump in and add there, what's interesting about that, Sean, is being a former Republican, it's almost not, it's not even a moral question for them. It's just a strategic one. It's one that they make very, very deliberately, and that is to get up and lie, to do whatever they have to do, say whatever they have to say. The ends always justify the means.
Well, and it's brilliant if you think about it. We don't live in a 24-hour news cycle. They're focused on winning the 10-second news cycle, winning whatever's right in front of them by whatever means necessary.
That's right. And it's the illusion of truth. It's the illusion of advocacy for the middle class that they've mastered. And I think it's time for the country to wake up. And we're talking about a penalty for not getting health insurance versus 30 million Americans being able to actually see a doctor. I just don't think that's much of a question.
Well, and, their rhetoric. I love that sign that I saw at a rally once. I think it was a Tea Party rally with some stragglers trying to infiltrate it. It said Fox News, rich people telling rich people, rich people being rich people paying rich people to tell middle class people how to blame poor people. Take it for what it's worth. This is the Tom Hartman Program. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Eric Burns. He's my partner at Bullfight Strategies, which you can find online at bullfightstrategies.org. He's on Twitter at Eric_E_Burns.
Lots of underscores.
Underscores how important it is that you follow him. You might remember him as the former president of Media Matters. And when we come back, we're going to chat a little bit more about what's happening in Washington as it relates to the Supreme Court and the conscience of an ex-right-wing teenage conservative after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, a right-wing 14-year-old has a change of heart.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. If you're just joining us, we are here in studio with Eric Burns, the former president of Media Matters and my business partner at Bullfight Strategies. You can find more about him online, bullfightstrategies.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at Eric_E_Burns. We'll make sure that we post his Twitter handle in Tom's feed as well. Eric, so you've got Republicans that are rushing to say that they're going to use reconciliation on this.
Yeah.
You've got, and those are just Republicans in the Senate. You've got Republicans in the House planning a vote to repeal the president's health care initiative. You've got Republican governors across the country saying that they're not going to implement parts of health care reform. Where does it stop? I mean, at what point do they accept defeat and know that this is the law of the land?
Well, look, the one thing that you know, we've learned about Republicans, Carl, you know, especially when we were, you know, working together on the Hill fighting, you know, Tom DeLay and the culture of corruption, is that, you know, Republicans, their greatest strength is also their greatest weakness. They will pound and pound on an issue, and sometimes they will, you know, essentially walk off of a cliff together. And I think that's really where they're headed with this. I don't think that we're going to see this abate. They've been planning this assault on the Affordable Health Care Act for 3 years now.
Well, it sounds like McConnell's getting close to announcing his plans for what to do when the Affordable Care Act is repealed. Let's hit clip 13.
The single biggest step we could take in the direction of improving American health care is to get rid of this
monstrosity. But if I may, sir, you're talking about repeal and replace. How would you provide universal coverage?
I'll get to it in a minute.
I'll get to it in a minute. He makes it sound like it's taking out the trash.
Well, can I just say, first of all, how refreshing is it to see Chris Wallace taking Mitch McConnell to task? I mean, when was the last time you actually saw that?
Maybe it's an homage to his recently passed father, who did a much better job than he's ever hoped of doing. But it was rather strange, I think.
Well, it just says a lot when all the Senate minority leader can say is what he's against and what he doesn't want to see. These guys don't have any solutions. This is about electoral politics. It's about, you know, and it's really a shame that these guys are allowed to get away with this, Carl. But it's how, like I said, we talked about it, it's how they operate. And Mitch McConnell doesn't believe that covering 30 million people that don't have health insurance is an issue. He said it in that same interview.
If they were all wealthy people, I don't think he'd care. I think he'd be very worried.
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, they would they'd be rolling out the red carpet.
Let's hear that clip that Eric just mentioned.
And I just want to ask, what specifically are you going to do to provide universal coverage to the 30 million people who are uninsured?
That is not the issue.
Right. With McConnell and the rest of the Republicans, issues are for tissues, I guess.
And I'd like to ask, Leader McConnell, what is the issue, and how long has he not been concerned about Americans?
There's
not being
only
able to see
one
doctors?
Issue, Eric. You don't even have to question. The single issue is that he said from day one that his biggest goal was this clip.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
And so we don't have to struggle to come up with a rationale as to why they think the things they think.
But this is what he's really saying. In order to prevent Barack Obama from having a second term, he wants to prevent millions and millions of Americans from being able to go see a doctor.
Yes.
And that is what this is.
Are you
is.
Saying that some of them could die?
I'm saying that many of them will die. And he doesn't care. And he doesn't want to improve it. I'm saying that my father passed away in large part because we have a really dysfunctional healthcare system. And I only wish that this bill had been passed 5 years ago. Mitch McConnell doesn't care.
No, he doesn't.
He just wants to please his donors and Grover Norquist.
He is single-minded in his determination to make sure the president fails. Let's hit Robert in Meridian, Texas. Hey, Robert.
Yes, I'm here. Hold on.
All right, I'll hold for you. It's only live radio, Robert.
Yeah, Meridian, Texas, Carl.
Hey, Robert.
Yes, my question is, play along with me on this. You know, Obamacare is such a horrible whatever, so let's not have it. Let's not have Social Security, taken out of my paycheck. Let's not have Medicare taken out of our check. So let's have all our mamas and daddies that are in their 60s and 70s die. And you know what I'm alluding to. So
I think you're alluding to Republican paradise.
Yeah, I mean, where's the logic in all this that's saying that we don't need health care for all?
I think your mistake there is looking for logic.
Well, there is logic though to it, and it's not. I mean, it's logic. It's not morality. It's not ethics. It's not compassion. You take it right back to Grover Norquist.
You can only go gulp for so long before everybody collapses.
You take it right back to Grover Norquist talking about he wants a government so small you can drown in the bathtub. Because, you know, these guys are wealthy.
But
they don't want to pay taxes.
If he had a chance to have that bathtub, something would come out years later that it was a government-funded bathtub. I mean, look at Ayn Rand, who died on her deathbed, like most people do, typically die on their deathbed, died while she was being taken care of by Social Security and government services. What is remarkable about conservatives is how completely unself-aware they are when it comes to their own connections to these issues. I mean,
no, you're absolutely right.
I mean, my favorite is the Reagan issue. You know, hoisting him up as a savior for the right after he raised taxes 11 times, ballooned the deficit, traded arms for hostages, dealt with terrorist organizations, left Marines to die. Passed passed abortion rights legislation in California and signed it into law, and more
convictions, Carl, for members of his administration for crimes than any other administration in American history.
Amnesty for millions of undocumented immigrants, and this is a guy who would never be able to be the Republican. I mean, you think that Mitt Romney stumbled his way to the Republican nomination this time around? Ronald Reagan could never have even hoped of getting the nomination. When we come back after this break, we are going to be talking to Nicholas Shaxson. He is the author of a new piece in Vanity Fair that analyzes where Mitt's money is and how he's been able to take advantage of all these tax loopholes and shady things that you've never even heard of. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're talking to Nicholas Shaxson from Vanity Fair about Mitt Romney's moolah. That's right. We're talking big money. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom this afternoon, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. I'm joined in studio by Eric Burns, my business partner at Bullfight Strategies, bullfightstrategies.com. You can find him on Twitter at Eric_E_Burns. I promise to get that linked up on Tom's Twitter account at some point today. You know, there's not a lot that's known about Mitt Romney's wealth. I mean, we know that he can bet $10,000 in a Republican debate, and we know that he doesn't think making a couple hundred grand off of making speeches is that much money, and that his wife's hobbies include dancing horses that take flights to England for the Olympic Games. But we really don't know much about his money, and that's by design. Joining us now to chat about where the money is and more is Nicholas Shaxson. He is a journalist and author of the Tax Haven book, Treasure Islands. He's got a great piece in Vanity Fair that I suggest you all go read at Vanity Fair's website called Where the Money Is. Nicholas, thanks for joining me.
Hi. Hello.
So you've got this great piece here. Why don't you tell folks a little bit about what led you to writing it and digging a little deeper than most people had gone?
Well, my background really is as a researcher on tax havens. I've been looking at these tax havens for several years, and I've long viewed them as kind of escape hatches from, you know, what I see as the sort of responsibilities of society, you know, taxes, financial regulations, criminal laws, all sorts of different things. So tax havens kind of, they are at the service of the sort of generally the wealthiest and most powerful elites in society around the world. I mean, not just in the United States, but in Europe and in Africa and all over the place. And so tax havens is kind of where I'm coming from. And So Mitt Romney was obviously, you know, there has been quite a bit in the news about his tax haven accounts, and I just started looking at looking a little bit under the hood.
Well, it's certainly an interesting read. Eric pointed out to me. I mean, Eric, you found this piece towards the beginning of the story where they talked to a younger, you know, former Bain, I guess intern or employee at one point.
Yeah.
Yeah, an intern.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was an interesting, it's an interesting tale where he's recounting his time working for Mitt Romney, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Nicholas, but he's essentially asked by Mitt Romney to, falsify his identity in order to get and obtain information on Bain Capital's clients, competitors, and that was one of the key business strategies that Mitt Romney pursued, which I think, some people would consider dishonest, which really just kind of fits, I think, one of the big takeaways I had from your article, Nicholas, was that Romney feels the rules don't apply to him. Is that, you think that's fair?
Well, I think that's sort of more or less fair. Basically, there has been, obviously this subject has been picked over by the U.S. media for months and years, indeed. And there has been a sort of general acceptance that he's done all these, tax deals and tax gimmicks and so on, but hasn't actually broken the law. But for me, having looked at, for years at tax havens and the people who use tax havens, you come to realize that between the two poles of tax evasion, which is by definition illegal, and tax avoidance, which is by definition not illegal, but it also by definition involves kind of getting around the spirit of the law. Between these two poles of the legal and the illegal, there's generally a significant gray area where you're not quite sure where you stand. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the key things in my article is it looks at, Mitt Romney seems very comfortable, striding boldly into these gray areas and kind of pushing the boundaries. And, you generally can't say, he did something that was outright illegal here. But a lot of it is very kind of questionable and, going a lot further than many people would. Having said that, there are a lot of people, powerful people on Wall Street who are also comfortable doing this. I mean, he's certainly not alone.
Well, I mean, he was one of those powerful people on Wall Street, essentially, wasn't he?
Well, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a representative of Wall Street, very much so. I think that for me is kind of the crux of the article. I was kind of surprised at how confident he was, striding into these fuzzy gray zones.
For the lay people at home who, don't have the luxury of, hiring anybody outside of H&R Block to do their taxes, do it themselves, on, the day before tax day, how exactly does Romney do this?
Well, there are actually a whole range of different ways of minimizing your tax bill. Some of them have been done through Bain Capital, the private equity firm that he spun off out of Bain & Co., the consulting firm, back in 1984. And one of the tricks he used was to play a very complicated game of squirting some particular kinds of shares into his retirement account, into his IRA that Bain provided, and then using all sorts of kind of Wall Street rocket fuel, those shares, once inside the IRA and protected from tax, were suddenly allowed to grow very, very fast indeed. And so you have this kind of tax-free money that that grows astonishingly fast inside the tax-protected IRA. And so you kind of skip around taxes in that way. And it's all sorts of, quite complicated shenanigans that he's used, and been involved in that I compare him to kind of like the superhero who does all sorts of backflips and twirls to get through the nest of laser beams, and emerge sort of unscathed. And I think in Mitt Romney's case with his haircut nicely intact, while everybody else kind of gets zapped. So it's financial acrobatics in many cases.
Do you think that it's unique or unusual that the media? I'll buy the piece that maybe they've talked a bit about his money and where it is. But I look at somebody like John Edwards 4 years ago, and all they could do was talk about how rich he was. It seems like the only people you hear talking about Romney's wealth on a regular basis are
Free Speech TV.
Yeah, people on Free Speech TV, sure. Stand-up comedians, Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, liberal pundits, but you certainly don't see this depth of reporting on this subject too often.
Well, I think, there's certainly been a lot written about him, and it's not like there's been silence on his haven accounts or anything like that. No question, there's been plenty of digging. I mean, I think my article produces a kind of package that looks at lots of different things and draws some conclusions. And I don't think there's been anything quite like that I've seen. There have been
a number of articles that have focused on specific aspects of his financial affairs, and boy, there are a lot of them to look at.
I'm guessing that there's been more conversation about Obama's birth certificate than there have been about Romney's taxes.
Well, I want to know, Nicholas, if you would agree with this. You know, Romney gets away with this. I mean, you've got to put a lot of time and energy into protecting these kind of assets. And, you know, when I read in Nicholas's article that Romney's generating a lot of his income, his actual income from Bain, by using a trick called carried interest, you know, he's evading taxes in principle, and he gets away with it every time.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say evade. I mean, evasion is technically, it means
avoid.
Avoid, yeah.
Carried interest, yeah, I mean, carried interest is a particular form of remuneration that attracts a very low tax rate, and there are a lot of people who argue that he's certainly breaking no laws by earning carried interest, not at all.
Sure,
But there is a whole argument that, you know, there are lots of people who actually know this stuff will argue that basically there's no way this stuff should be taxed at this very low rate.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me. I mean, yeah, there has been quite a bit of coverage about Romney's money and where it comes from and how he's invested it over the years. Typically, though, we have conversations about conflicts of interest when we talk about candidates. And what you don't hear often is how Mitt Romney would do by the economic policies that he's proposing. I mean, one of the reasons he's, you know, a favorite on Wall Street is because all of these loopholes that he's taken advantage of, that he's, you know, kind of gone between those poles of avoidance and evasion, are things that he's going to maintain.
Yes, I think so. I mean, we obviously have to see what exactly he would come out to, you know, to be elected. But one of the other issues that I try to stress in my argument that I've seen much, much less discussion of in the article in the U.S. media is this issue of what some people call financialization. In other words, where you have, you know, business managers who in the past were, you know, focused on building great companies, building really good, you know, efficient companies that make, you know, better and cheaper widgets, and a move towards a much more kind of financial Wall Street view of this. And the private equity business, and Bain Capital is a prime representative of that, the private equity business is in the business of viewing corporations not through, you know, making real productivity. I mean, of course, they are, you know, they do create productivity gains in companies like any other manager does, but they seek to extract financial returns, and that has involved a lot of leverage, a lot of borrowing, and basically you borrow a lot of money by creating new financial projections, and then you pay yourself a huge dividend, you the few wealthy investors.
It really is a win-win-win situation. Nicholas Shackson, I want to thank you for your great piece in Vanity Fair. Everybody listening at home, you can go to his website, Treasure Island, treasureislands.org. Pick up a copy of his book. Follow him on Twitter. That's at Nick Shackson, S-H-A-X-S-O-N. Vanity Fair, also on Twitter. Eric Burns has been joining me in studio. Eric, thanks for sticking around with us.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we'll be talking to Bob McGahee, the conference director of the Conference on National Affairs.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, young people are not so apathetic after all. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today, this afternoon. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-TOM. Actually, it's 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. You can also go online at tomhartman.com and send your questions in. Follow us on Twitter, Tom_Hartman. Follow me at Carl Frisch. You know, I've been involved politically for quite a long time. You know, I was one of those weird kids in high school that was active in politics. It was a former life when I was a Republican, but nonetheless, I was involved politically. I don't know what it was that got my interest, but I know that about 10th grade, I got involved in this program through the YMCA called YMCA Youth and Government out in California, and it's in 40-some-odd states now. But I was in California where I grew up, and I was involved in this program through my local YMCA, the Westchester Family YMCA. And it was that program that taught me about public speaking, you know, taught me how to study up on issues and to pay attention to what was happening in my community and in my state and in my country. And in this program, it was a model legislature and court program where students participate and play roles, you know, in Sacramento, for a week, acting as senators and assembly people, elected officials. They run for office at conferences in advance. They serve as governors, lieutenant governors, lobbyists. They work in the newsroom. They really do recreate, what it means, to be a public servant in Sacramento. The governor comes and speaks every year. And it was in that program that I really got my interest in politics. I was a lieutenant governor, and I was a right-wing Republican running around with all my high school friends who were all liberal. Thankfully, they put up with me. But I would run around and talk politics with my friends. It was, you know, I lived for it. And each summer, there was a national program out in North Carolina that the states would send their top delegates to every single summer. And I went out to that every summer in high school, and eventually was a presiding officer 15 years ago. It was a long time ago. We're trying to get Bob McGahee on the phone. He's the conference director for the YMCA Youth Conference on National Affairs, which we affectionately call CONA. And it was at that program that I met people from all over the country, and my positions on issues began to shift. It was really easy for me to stay isolated in California as a lone conservative, but when I got to experience and meet people from different walks of life, different political backgrounds, and, you know, just great people all around, I started to slowly shift. I came out of the closet. I eventually switched parties. I started working for Democrats and saw the light, so to speak. So it really is a great program. You can find them online at, let's see here, it is YMCA CONA, that's CONA.org. Give them a donation. They are taking donations online, ymcacona.org, to help fund scholarships so that people from around the country who can't afford can go to their conference. Check them out. You can also follow them on Twitter, YMCA_CONA. We're taking your calls while we try to connect with Bob. Let's talk to David in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, David.
My question is, I'm a military vet. So.
Sorry, David. We can't make out what you're saying. You're going to have to give us a call back. Let's talk to Patrick in Plattsburgh, New York. Hey, Patrick.
Hello, Carl. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How's that lake doing there?
Huh?
How's Lake Champlain treating you?
It's bad, man. We got your Vermont Yankee got opened back up, and they're leaking their crap right back into the lake.
It's horrible.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
And the company people are from Louisiana, and they don't even have to live up here and deal with it.
Of course not.
I hate to get off subject about something. I want you to, if you remember what happened with Toyota Car Company a few years back.
What's that?
When the cars were surging.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
I think they were sabotaged because the same thing happened to Audi in the 80s. The quality of the cars were way better than American cars, and then the prices were dropped. And then all of a sudden, these people were getting killed in these cars, and they're just turning the cars on with the car in park, and it was surging forward. Same thing that happened to Toyota.
It certainly didn't work very well. Toyota's still selling pretty well, so we'll just chalk that up to an interesting conspiracy theory. Let's talk to Bob McGahee. Hey, Bob, how are you?
How are you?
I'm good. So, Bob, I've known Bob a long time. I was talking about that YMCA Youth Conference on National Affairs that really activated that political gene in me. Bob is the conference director. I've known Bob since I was probably 17, 16 years old.
I've got stories, but I promise not to tell them, Carl.
Well, I always tell people on the radio, I say I experimented with being a Reagan-quoting conservative in my youth while other people were experimenting with other more fun things. Bob, are you there?
Yes.
So why don't you tell people in your own words, the conference is happening right now in Black Mountain, North Carolina. You've got delegates from all over the country. What are they talking about there?
Let me give you a little background. We have 35 states represented.
Wow.
598 delegates, 735 total people. I think we were about 350 delegates when you were here last. So it has definitely grown.
That's excellent.
Even in the hard economic times, we were amazed that the numbers continued to grow rather than decline, and that showed an interest in what we were all about here.
Well, it's also a testament to the ability for people that have donated money to help, you know, let students who can't necessarily afford
without
attend.
That, it would not have been possible. Absolutely.
And people can make a donation at ymcacona.org. That's ymcacona.org. Bob, how long have you been involved with the program?
The program has been around. This is our 45th year.
Wow.
I have attended 40 of those 45. I missed, as I jokingly say, I was a prisoner of war in North Dakota for 4 years when I was working in the YMCA in North Dakota, and I was at that far, and so I did not get back during those years. But other than that, I have been here from the beginning, missed out in the middle, and back in the end.
Well, I got to tell you, we've only got a little bit of time left to go before we have to take a hard break. Bob, but I tell people every chance I get, I would not be what I am today without that program.
Well, it's that unique opportunity to meet people like mine and opposite mine to share opinions, ideas, ideals, and learn from each other.
That's right.
In an environment that's safe, even though it may be hard to debate.
It is, and it's truly unique. Bob, I want to thank you for joining me today. That's Bob McGahee, the conference director of the YMCA Conference on National Affairs. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch as well. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. It's 6 minutes after the top of the hour. Joining me now to talk about more when it comes to the Supreme Court and what's been going on with the health care reform battle that we thought was over, and much more, is Doug Kendall. He is the founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and he is kind enough to join us on his vacation. Doug, how are you?
Thanks for having me, Carl.
Well deserved, I might add. You had an amicus brief in that that challenge to the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, and it turned out pretty well.
Yeah, we actually filed two briefs, one on each of the two big issues, the spending clause and the commerce clause, both on behalf of, we represented over 500 state legislators from around the country, from each of the 50 states.
But Doug, I thought the state officials were opposed to Obamacare.
Well, that's one of the, one of the myths that the right tells you about this. We had, again, more than 500 legislators from every state in the union saying we desperately need the federal government to take a lead in solving the healthcare crisis. And it's a story that wasn't told enough as part of the battle, but it's definitely a big part of the story.
Well, and your argument was pretty straightforward. I mean, it was look at the text and history of the Constitution. The founders saw a need for a federal government that was strong enough to handle national problems, right?
Exactly right. We founders created a government where the states were dominant. That was called the Articles of the Confederation, and then we replaced that with the Constitution we have, which gave the federal government the problem to solve truly national problems. And that's exactly what we argued to the court, and for the most part, happily, that was what the court ruled.
So how do you solve a problem like Republican governors?
Well, I mean, we actually have a problem still going forward, as you alluded to up front. I mean, you have one of the things that the ruling did was give states a little more ability to say, you know, we don't want to help, we don't want to participate in this program. Now, it's a stupid decision. It's a genuine, if a state decides not to take the federal money for expansion of Medicaid, they are truly, truly disadvantaging their citizens.
Well, what does that mean in real terms? What happens when a state decides that?
Well, if states going forward decide that they don't want to participate in the expansion of Medicaid, they can, but it will mean that their citizens don't get tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of federal aid for to make sure that the poorest of their citizens get health care. And so, again, it's a choice they can make. It's a choice that would be truly horrific for the most needy citizens in these states.
Now, does that mean that all of Obamacare doesn't apply to those states or just those portions?
There's just certain portions that are tied to the expansion, to the money that comes with the expansion of Medicaid.
So really this is just a proverbial Republican middle finger to the Obama White House in an effort to stir up the Tea Party base.
Well, to the Obama White House, but also to, you know, the most needy of their citizens.
Oh, they wouldn't even dignify those people with any kind of hand gesture.
Well, that's, that would be the...
the argument I would make.
There's a political aspect to this, but there's also a human tragedy involved in this that I think.
And is there any recourse that people could have with their states to force them in this way?
Well, I think I think on the plus side, it is an incredibly powerful political argument that in times where states are struggling as mightily as they are to make ends meet, that it is suicide on ideological grounds for a state to say, you know what, we're going to refuse tens of millions of dollars of federal funding. And even though the federal government's going to pick up the 100% of the tab of giving people in your state health care, which is what they're going to do for the first 3 years, and then it drops down to only 90%. Despite this incredibly generous federal funding of health care for the neediest people in your state, we're going to turn that down. We're going to let these people not have health care. It's the greatest let them eat cake argument since Marie Antoinette and the French Revolution. And I think it should be, and that's, I think, where progressives need to focus on this. It should be political suicide for anyone who turns down this money. That's just an argument that needs to be made loud and clear.
Well, and it just strikes me that, you know, even after the Supreme Court comes out and says this is constitutional, they still don't realize that they've lost the fight. It's quite sad. And you're right, it does have a real human element impact here. But it wasn't the only decision decided by this court. Constitutional Accountability Center was also involved in the immigration battle that took place on the Supreme Court and was announced the week before. What all did you do in regards to the lawsuit challenging SB 1070 in Arizona?
Well, again, it's actually kind of a similar argument, Carl. It was basically the argument that that the Constitution, which talks about the need for a uniform rule when it comes to naturalization and immigration, means what it says, that the Constitution gives the federal government unique power to set the rule for the entire country, and that's what the Supreme Court should follow. And again, by and large, by a split vote, the Supreme Court held that in the SB 1070 case. They struck down three of the four challenged provisions of SB 1070, and they really cabined the fourth one that they let go into effect. They basically said, yeah, we'll let the show your papers provision go into effect, the provision that everybody's very afraid will lead to racial profiling.
Right, it really severely targets Canadians, right?
Right, exactly. People are going to be pulled over for being Canadian all the time. And it is a problematic provision, and the court said as much and just said, you know, we're not going to strike it down now, but once it goes into force, we're going to see how it's enforced. And, you know, it may be preempted by federal law. It may be unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause, but it's on life support.
It was a bit like a babysitter. I thought it was a bit like a babysitter telling, you know, children, you better be on your best behavior, but they've never babysat those children before. And by children, I mean Arizona. I mean, like... I don't anticipate that Arizonans, who are elected to office are going to be handling this in the right way.
It gives them a very short leash and says we're not done looking at this. And as soon as you can show that, in fact, they're doing what as soon as we, meaning the people who are on watching what Arizona does, as soon as we're able to show that they're in fact using this law as a racial profiling law, the court will step back in, and that's a good news about it.
Well, I think it's important. I mean, you're really threading something here that I think is important to point out. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Doug Kendall. He's the founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which you can find online at the usconstitution.org. That's the usconstitution.org. And Doug, if you can stick around, I'd love to chat with you. It seems that there's a thread between these two cases and other things that you all have been involved in, where it's really turning this game of constitutional, you know, back and forth on its head by saying, look, there is a progressive argument to make with the text and history of our Constitution. It sounds like that's a fight worth having, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Carl. It's, and one of the things that's most gratifying about the healthcare decision is Justice Ginsburg's concurrence and dissent. She concurs in part and dissents in part, makes that argument really clearly.
Well, and we'll dig a little bit deeper into that after this break. Stick around. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman. We're with Doug Kendall from the Constitutional Accountability Center, and we'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Coming up, more on the Constitution with Doug Kendall. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today. All afternoon, I'm Carl Frisch. It's 20 after. We are talking to Doug Kendall. He is the founder and president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which you can find online at the usconstitution.org. You can follow them on Twitter at MyConstitution. Doug, thanks for sticking around.
Thanks for having me, Carl.
So before we went to that break, we were talking a bit about how progressives can be using the text and history of our Constitution to their advantage. I know that's an effort by your organization to build a progressive movement, the Constitutional Progressives. Why is it so important that we start threading that needle?
Well, it's just reclaiming the Constitution, Carl. The Constitution is our founding document. It's one document that kind of people love across the political spectrum, and it's a stunningly progressive document if you look carefully at its text and history. It was created by revolutionaries who wanted to both protect liberty but also create a government that could solve national problems. And it's been amended 27 times, mostly by social reform efforts, such as the effort after the Civil War to end slavery and to protect, expand liberty and protect equal protection, and then the expanding the vote, women's vote movement, and then expanding the vote again in the youth vote movement after the Vietnam War. And so the Constitution, its text and history are both incredibly important in the national debate, but also being claimed by conservatives in ways that we shouldn't let them, because they're not true. And so the fundamental principle of constitutional progressives is that the Constitution's text and history matter, and that we can claim it and we can win political fights based on it. And I think the Affordable Care Act case is a perfect example. That is solving a national problem like the healthcare crisis is exactly what the Constitution was established to allow the federal government to do. And the conservatives, the only thing you've been hearing about the Constitution is the conservatives whine about, the fact this is beyond the powers of the federal government. That's bunk. And yet we've let them dominate this argument based, because they're just loud and they scream about it. And
because we've been largely silent until recently.
That's exactly right. We haven't been loud enough. We haven't, even still, the politicians who are defending the Affordable Care Act generally don't engage in the constitutional debate. We talk about why it's a good thing for the people. We don't explain that the federal government has to have powers to solve national problems, and it does under our Constitution.
And that translates into those weird polls that we saw where Democrats supported the planks of the Affordable Care Act, but when asked if it was constitutional, they all said no.
That's right.
It made no sense.
We believe the right-wing talking points on the Constitution rather than what the founders actually said about the document. And that's got to change if we're going to do better in these political debates.
Well, one thing that caught my eye was a blog post on your website, theusconstitution.org, about the Chamber of Commerce's ability to win court cases. How'd they do this time around?
You know, so they filed in seven cases that came to a decision, and they won all seven. And that's just totally part of a trend that we've seen over the last 7 years since Chief Justice Roberts became chief.
So the Chamber of Commerce got involved in seven cases, and they won all of the cases they put themselves into.
Yeah, they were actually involved in a few more than that, but the other cases just had a mixed result where they themselves say it's neither a win or a loss.
Okay.
But so every case where they won or lost, they won. They didn't lose a single case. They participated in this term, and that brings their total percentage in the Roberts Court up to 68%, meaning they're winning over two-thirds of the cases where they filed.
And things were much closer in previous courts, weren't they?
Yeah, even, you know, you think of the Rehnquist Court, the court under Chief Justice William Rehnquist, as a very conservative court, a very business-friendly court. Yet the chamber was only winning about 56% of cases during that time, so it's bumped up another 12%. You know, as another benchmark during the Berger Court, which was a kind of moderate conservative court 20, 30 years ago, the chamber was winning about 44% of their cases. So their winning percentage has jumped almost 30% over the last over the last 20 years.
Now, I'm going to jump out on a limb here and guess that Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ginsburg are not the most reliable chamber votes.
No, that's right.
On the bench.
Although, you know, although, to be honest, they vote for the chamber around half the time. It's not like they don't ever side with business. They
well, and the chamber's not always evil either when it gets involved in cases, right? It's not always evil.
No, that's right. There's some cases, you know, where we side with the chamber. It's not that their positions are always evil or even certainly not always wrong. They should win some of the cases, but they shouldn't win two-thirds of the cases. And some of the conservative justices vote with the chamber 80%.
So who, pray tell, are the justices that side with the chamber most often?
Well, it's really the conservative bloc is pretty similar on this. So they all vote for the chamber somewhere between 70% and 80%. And so there's some variation between the justices on the conservative wing, but they're all they all vote for the chamber in a very high percentage of the case.
Which I guess is one of the reasons why the right wing was just gobsmacked about Chief Justice Roberts siding with them, and you know, with the former liberal members.
No, that's right. It was a surprising performance by Chief Justice Roberts at the end of the term. He sided with the liberal wing of the court in the two most important end of the term.
Yeah.
Immigration and healthcare case.
Doug, I want to thank you for joining us. This is Doug Kendall, the president and founder of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which you can find at theusconstitution.org. Doug, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Carl. Okay.
All right. We'll be back with even more after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, Tina Dupuy, syndicated columnist and friend of Carl.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Hello, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom and having some technical earpiece issues, I'm Carl Frisch. Filling in for Tom all this afternoon. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. You can also find more from me on Twitter at Carl Frisch, or look me up on Facebook as well. Joining me now to talk about everything that's going on today in our politics and in her opinion is my good friend Tina Dupuy.
Speaking of funny and smart, I want to bring on Tina Dupuy, managing editor of crooksandliars.com.
I'm a politician, which means I'm a crook and a liar.
Oh, Tina.
Tina Dupuy is brilliant. She's funny. She's a terrific writer.
Tina does everything, and I just love her already.
Good afternoon, Tina.
Hi, Carl. How are you?
I'm doing well. You are now the editor-in-chief of Soapblocks. What is Soapblocks?
Soapblocks.net is a startup publication. We're now in alpha mode, and we plan on doing a hard launch in 2 months, just before the convention.
It sounds exciting. It sounds like a great way for people to get their opinions out there.
Yeah, absolutely. We're doing this new technology we've patented called Paying Bloggers. it's a big thing.
What is that? Ariana just came into my studio. What is a paid blogger, Tina Dupuy? I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, monetizing content. Who would have thunk?
So
it would be radical.
It sounds like a interesting new gig, and you're now living in New York City.
I am.
I'm
calling you from my office, and I said it was Soho, and someone corrected me. I'm in Chinatown. I don't know. That sounds cooler.
Tina's gotten all professional on us. So what do you make of everything that's going on with the Supreme Court and the right-wing reaction?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that a lot of people thought, because the Republicans talk about the Constitution all the time,
right,
that they would automatically go, well, you know, as soon as the Supreme Court settles it as being constitutional or not constitutional, that would be the end of it. And, you know, immediately forever reasonable member of the Senate, the Honorable Rand Paul, immediately came out and said, it doesn't matter if the Supreme Court says that it's constitutional, it's still unconstitutional. Which, you know, is like saying, it doesn't matter that they have hair on their face, they're still not a mammal. it doesn't matter if there's a law that says it's legal, it's still illegal. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. They've gone from loud to shrill. If you sit back and think about it, there are people who are still pissed off about the Civil War. So why do we think that, you know, a Supreme Court decision that was a 5-4 decision is going to settle things more than, you know,
Are you at all surprised that the people that are still ticked off about the Civil War are the same people that are ticked off about health care reform?
I am not shocked. There's gambling going on in this casino.
So where do we go from here then? Do we just keep fighting?
Yeah, I think that they're going to, like, you know, you put them in a corner, they scream and scream and scream until they tire themselves out, and then they move on to the next thing. I mean, what we really need to do as progressives or Democrats or whatever is actually sell this Affordable Health Care Act. The thing is that the Obamacare people have been spending, I think it's somewhere three times more than we've been spending to educate people as to what's in ACA. So, and to me, it's a big step forward for equality, for women. It's a big step forward for the rights of the elderly and the sick, that they won't be denied health care, that you'll be able to actually live in America and not have to file bankruptcy if you get sick. I mean, these are huge human rights issues that we've moved forward on. We've made progress.
Well, Tina, I want to speak on behalf of conservative listeners that might be hearing you.
Yeah,
yes, Tina, what you say makes sense, but it was signed into law by a black man.
Right. And a Democrat. Here's the thing. I mean, we just realized the dream of Nixon by having an individual mandate. And the first thing, as soon as the Supreme Court a decision came down, I was like, this is brilliant, because John Roberts has managed to keep the country away from socialized medicine by calling what they have socialized medicine. It's amazing. So we actually, the public option is now officially dead. It's not going to happen. And that's thanks to the traitor, Justice John Roberts.
Well, and it's been
weird. I mean, this is as weird as politics gets. And And politics in this country is weird, and this is, like, as strange. I mean, now that it's, you know, an abomination, it's going to kill us all for the, you know, for Gingrich's big idea of how to combat Hillary care is now that it's law and it's been upheld by the Supreme Court, now, you know, we're doomed.
I would love to be a fly on the wall in right-wing offices across the country, because you've got these right-wingers, you know, whether they're members of Congress, all basically, I don't know if you saw that video of Jean Schmidt, you know, when she found out that what she thought was healthcare reform being overturned. You've got all these people basically disavowing Roberts because he's not sufficiently conservative, because he stood up for the Constitution. I think it's hysterical to hear these, you know, freshman congressmen saying, well, I'm not going to be his friend anymore.
He has been in the majority 93% of the time this term in this uber incredibly conservative court. He's been in the majority 93% of the time.
Well, and we just had Doug Kendall from the...
My favorite was John Yoo today saying that that this was the guy who was the author of the torture memos, quite famously, is now coming out against John, who's also a Bushy, who's coming out against John Roberts saying that he didn't interpret the Constitution correctly, which is my favorite. I was just like, I can't, it's really...
His logic is torture. You know, puns are the highest form of humor. What's remarkable, you nailed it. I mean, Roberts 90% of the time with the majority this time around. And I just had Doug Kendall from the Constitutional Accountability Center on in the last, segment. And he said that the Chamber of Commerce went 7-for-7 this term in terms of winning its cases that it got involved in.
Yes. Right. So all of a sudden, John Roberts is a pinko commie who is a Birkenstock wearing hippie. And wants to burn the Constitution. If you think about it, the conservatives are still pissed off about the New Deal. You know, there are big conservatives who have in recent history come out against women's suffrage, civil rights. They're still mad about Roe versus Wade and the Loving decision. I mean, there's a lot of things that they're still kind of mad about. The interesting thing about conservatives is that anytime they feel that, like, I don't know, that human rights, that equal rights, civil rights are somehow an equal sum game. So as soon as that a group of people have more rights, that means that there's someone else that has to have fewer in their mind. So they somehow, anytime an American gets greater acceptance in this world, or in the case of the Affordable Health Care Act, better access to health care, suddenly conservatives strangely get to make themselves out to be the victims.
Well, and they love positioning themselves in that way. It detracts from their personal responsibility given any topic.
Right. They're no longer bullies, then they get to be martyrs.
Right. I mean, you see that with the Christianists in response to the LGBT civil rights community.
Exactly.
Playing the victim, you know, how bad they have it, given that everybody basically in power in Washington is a Christian.
Right.
They've got it
and
so
that,
tough.
Right. That gays being able to marry somehow is an affront to Christianity, being able to hate who they want.
Well, I'm interested to know, you're now in New York City, how different you feel the politics are. I mean, obviously we've chatted to some degree about how, yes, lots of people talk politics in Washington. One of the reasons that we became friends in L.A. when I lived in L.A. was because I could talk politics with you and you didn't know anybody else who talked politics. Are you finding it the same in New York?
No, I'm finding people, you know, walking down the street, people want to talk about politics and, you know, and everybody, seriously, like, you know, I mean, there's, you know, on the subway. It's a different culture than Los Angeles. For one, people at least pretend to read, so that makes them, you know, more interesting.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you're not going to drive a car, you might as well have something to do on the subway.
And New York has a unique, you know, it has a 24-hour news program just dedicated to New York politics. So, I mean, their local politics here is a blood sport and has been for a very long time. And they actually have more representation per capita than you do in Los Angeles. There's something like 52 city councilmen in New York as
right.
13 in LA. So, and they have more civic engagement here. And
they've got so many council
people
in fact that I've got, like, I have a friend running for city council currently in New York City. So that's how many they have.
Is your friend different than my friend? Because
I very well could be.
I know.
Corey Johnson.
Exactly. Who?
His name's Corey Johnson. He's running in Chelsea, Manhattan.
But I also have a friend running for city council, and it's not Corey Johnson. So how's that?
Is it Kevin Bacon? Well,
it should be.
Your column, I want to direct people to tinadupuy.com. Your column was a good one. Headline, bold, GOP, boldly offering solutions to our nation's symptoms. I'd love if you stuck around and chatted with me about it after this break.
Absolutely, Carl.
All righty. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. We're chatting with Tina Dupuy, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, the GOP has a cure for what ails, and if they don't, they'll just make you ail.
Shake that.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I am Carl Frisch, and I'm joined by Tina Dupuy, the editor-in-chief of Soapbox, my friend and the syndicated columnist. Tina, thanks for sticking around.
Thanks for keeping me.
So you write in your column this week, GOP boldly offering solutions to our nation's symptoms. Nothing says leadership more than bravely standing up against a concern that's not actually a problem. We've had a one-sided battle with Sharia law in the U.S. No one is fighting for replacing the U.S. laws with an Islamic moral code, but nonetheless, Republicans are heroically fighting against it. Same with aborted fetuses and commercial foodstuffs. Not something that's ever happened, but earlier this year, Republican freshman Oklahoma State Senator Ralph Shortley had the temerity to introduce a bill to outlaw it. Same thing with voter fraud and a number of other issues, right?
Right, exactly. The biggest of this is building that dang fence and securing the border. Well, the border is secure, and there's more money being spent on that border than there ever has been before, the border with Mexico.
And we have net zero immigration from Mexico at this point.
You got it. That's exactly it. So because our economy is in the tank and we don't have we don't have a need.
But that's not the only reason, right, Tina? That's not the only reason. I mean, it's one of the reasons. But Obama's put more, boots on the ground at the border. He's done more for enforcement and deportation than George Bush did in 8 years.
Right. You got it. So, but that's not, but conservatives are, they are able to, just stand up and boldly offer simple solutions to trumped up problems that they've kind of created. And they look like they're actually doing something. So it's embracing bureaucracy and busy work, where they look like they're actually doing things, when really the only thing that the Republicans in Congress are now running on is undoing things. They want to de-accomplish everything possible, and so they're going to not do anything until just that happens.
Well, and I heard Mitch McConnell said earlier, I guess today or yesterday, that he was willing to use reconciliation to push through the removal of the Affordable Care Act. How do you think that plays? These are the same people that didn't want reconciliation used to pass health care reform in the first place.
Now they're going to try and do a technical issue in order to, these are the same people that, when they are in the minority, they want to get rid of the filibuster, and then when they're in the majority, they want to get rid of the filibuster, and as soon as they're in the minority, they abuse it to the point where it just breaks the Senate entirely.
Well, and let's be clear. I mean, they've used the filibuster more in these 3 years of the Obama administration
exponentially
than Democrats used in the entirety of the Bush administration.
You got it. But they come out with these problems that don't actually exist, except for in very dark corners of the internet. The aborted fetuses and foodstuffs is a good example of this, where they decide that there's something horrible going on, and regardless of any evidence of that horrible thing going on, they want to go pass a law in order to change it. And it keeps them from actually accomplishing anything, but it makes them look like, they're doing stuff.
Well,
how many times do we have to be warned against the Black Panthers and Acorn and Obama?
Not even the Black Panthers, right? The new Black Panthers, all six of them.
New Black Panthers, right? I thought there's six now. I thought there was only three. I don't know. I guess they're doubling.
Well, you know? It's not all good for Republicans. I mean, your other piece that you wrote recently about Mitt Romney just being himself, which I think is really, duplicitous on your part to suggest such a thing. What did you mean by that? I mean, here's what I picture when Mitt Romney is himself. I picture him behind a closed door of a closet, and not because I think he's gay. I then picture him hanging his human-like flesh suit on a hanger, and then breaking out the oil can and getting all of his joints, and then plugging into the electrical outlet for a nightly charge.
Look, I think John Stewart said it best when he said, you know, he looks like the guy who just fired your dad. You know, I mean, he's a really rich guy. His wife does really rich people things. You know, she
like
wears
what?
$1,000 t-shirt and says, you know, I don't really feel very wealthy.
But she drives
a
couple Cadillacs and has dancing horses.
Just a couple of Cadillacs. You know, her hobby is like some ridiculous sport that I've never heard of because I'm not in that tax bracket.
Dressage?
Near that tax
You've
bracket.
Never heard of dressage?
Exactly.
By the way, before we move on from the point about dressage, I just want you to know how clearly it is a rich person's sport. The Romneys will be flying their horse on an airplane, to England to compete in horse dancing.
They have airplanes for horses. They have elevators for cars.
It's
you know, I mean,
wait for
really
it. Here comes
people.
The pun. Here comes the pun. It's Mare Force One.
Oh, God. Did you work on that?
No, it just came to me, thankfully. I didn't have to spend any time coming up with it.
I don't know which is worse.
So why do you want him to be himself?
Because he's trying to be this guy who likes grits and saying y'all, and he really wants Michigan to vote for him, even though that's not going to happen. It's a blue state that Obama saved their main source of revenue in the state, the car industry. But he kind of goes there and he tries to be chummy and he tries to talk about things that people eat, like sandwiches and.
Tina, I've got some breaking news. My good friend Clay Johnson and his wonderful wife, Rosalind Lemieux, are happy to announce the birth of their first son, Felix Lemieux Johnson, who was born at 10 till 4 this afternoon. People will remember Clay as the author of The Information Diet. He's been on Tom's show before. And he's one of the co-founders of Blue State Digital. So congratulations to Clay and Roz and baby Felix. Tina, I don't think that Romney would ever take your advice, but that's why you're not working on his campaign, I suppose.
Darn.
All right, folks. It's been a delight talking to you, Tina. You can follow Tina online at tinadupuy.com, and be sure to go follow her on Twitter, at Tina Dupuy. We'll be back in just
a
bit.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. It is 6 after the top of the hour. Filling in for Tom this afternoon. In this final hour, I am Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. Go follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. That's K-A-R-L-F-R-I-S-C-H. It seems like months and months ago, but it was only weeks ago that President Obama came out and finally said that he supported marriage equality. And what you might not know is that on the November ballot, while President Obama stands for re-election, several states are going to be debating the subject whether or not we should have marriage equality. In the state of Maryland and Washington, voters will be deciding whether or not bills signed into law that legalized same-sex unions should stand. And in Minnesota, they'll be deciding on a constitutional amendment to ban marriage equality, while in Maine, they will be voting on an initiative that creates marriage equality. Joining me now, we're going to have a series of conversations with folks from each of the different states that have these subjects coming before their voters, And joining me now to talk about it is one that hits pretty close to home for me, because I have an interesting tie to the debate in Maryland, but also it's right next door to Washington, D.C., where we have marriage equality. So joining me now is Josh Levin. He is the campaign manager for Marylanders for Marriage Equality. Josh, thanks for joining me.
Carl, good to talk to you.
So my weird tie to the marriage equality fight in Maryland is a guy named Sam Arora, who you might be familiar with.
Oh, I've heard a bit.
So to fill people in, Sam Arora is a delegate from Maryland who, you know, I've known for going on 7 or 8 years. And, you know, when he was running for the legislature, I had a couple friends running at the same time, two in Maryland, Sam and Judd Legum, and then my friend Sarah Buxton in Vermont, where they also have marriage equality. And Sam was very clear with us. He said, look, I support marriage equality. I'll co-sponsor the bill. I can't wait to get to Annapolis. And then, you know, he did an about face and kind of shocked all of us. But nonetheless, through the hard work of organizations like yours, Governor O'Malley, Martin O'Malley, signed marriage equality into law, and now voters will be deciding whether or not it should stand. How are things going?
They're going well, and, you know, as Governor Dean used to say, that turned out not to be true with our friend Sam. But, no, you're right. Here in Maryland, things are going well. We've had an awful lot of positive developments over the last year. As you probably know, we came up a little bit short in 2011
right.
when they tried to pass this through the legislature. But with the leadership of the governor and our LGBT caucus and many of our allies here in the state, we were able to get it passed through the legislature this year, and the governor signed it into law on March 1st. But the new law, the Civil Marriage Protection Act, it doesn't go into effect until the beginning of January next year.
Right.
And between here and there, our opponents have collected the signatures they need to put it on the ballot. So Marylanders for Marriage Equality is the organization that was created to advocate for and now defend the new law at the ballot box.
And people can find your organization at marylandersformarriageequality.org. Obviously, they can find it by Google as well, but they can also follow you on Twitter at MD4Equality, the number 4 Equality. So how are things going? I know one thing that kind of shocked me, I'm interested to get your take, is after President Obama came out and supported marriage equality, numbers shifted dramatically in Maryland.
They really did. You know, we always looked at Maryland as being a great state to be the first in the country to affirm marriage equality at the ballot box. This is a state that is strongly Democratic. The president won by 25 points here back in 2008. And the population and the voting patterns are pretty favorable to us. The polling at the time the governor signed the law in the wake of that fight and the good news there, the polling put us up about 8 points.
Right.
52% in favor to 44% against here in the state, and that's likely voters. We were looking ahead, and we were trying to figure out how we were going to make sure that we defend this on the ballot, and we looked at sort of two potential pathways. One was to work with the population in Maryland that still exists here. We have moderate Republicans in this state
right.
who are willing to support this law, and we're very happy to have their support. We work with a lot of them. And we also knew that we had some ground that we could make up with African-American voters. And we were looking at both of those being good options, and we were moving forward. And then the president made his announcement, and what we saw was that support in the African-American community absolutely spiked. It was a great thing for us. It moved our polling in general all the way up to about 57% in favor, which is some of the best we've ever seen on this issue around the country.
Right.
Now, you know, we know that that's going to fall back a little bit. There's a period here where both
well, the right still they still have to your opponents still have to run their ads saying that you're going to hurt children and how, you know, there's nothing wrong with being against marriage equality and that they're really not hateful against gays and lesbians and blah 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 blah, the same stuff they've tried everywhere.
Right, and we expect that to be the case, and that's why we're building a campaign that can hopefully be the first one to push that back. You know, the leadership of figures like Governor O'Malley, like Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, so many of the local electeds who came together to help make this happen in the state is great. But we also need to work directly with the LGBT community in the state, all of our straight allies. SEIU 1199 and the State Council sit on our board, and they've been doing great work with their members, reaching out in their members' communities as well. It's just having conversations step by step, day by day across the state to let people know what this means, to let people know that this is about loving and committed couples, thousands of same-sex couples and their kids in Maryland who just want to have the same rights and protections that everybody else does.
Well, and it's a fight that's going to be expensive too. What are you guys looking at in terms of the money that's going to be spent there?
You know, it's a good question. We think that the ballot fight on our end will probably cost about $7.5 million, give or take. We've seen ballot measures in this state that have been a little bit more expensive than that, and we've seen ballot measures that have been less expensive. But we're comfortable if we can raise and spend in that range, and that's what our goal is right now. Maryland is not going to be, we expect, a contested state for the presidential race. Looks like the president will win the electoral votes from this state. But we do have to contend with a very expensive Washington, D.C. media market, where we have to deal with not just presidential advertising
sure.
aimed at Virginia, but Senate races and all sorts of other things.
Now, are the agents against change, the groups like National Organization for Marriage, are they trying to conceal their sources of income like they have in all these other states?
They are. And it was really interesting. When our opponents submitted their last batch of signatures just a little over a week ago, they submitted a report that said that they were $88,000 in debt. Right now, as part of their petitioning efforts, which we thought was really interesting because they admitted to a Baltimore Sun reporter that they had raised additional money that they had not disclosed at that time. Now, it's an open question whether or not that's legal.
Uh-huh.
They do have to figure out how to pay off those debts. We had a little fun because when we found those numbers, when those numbers were made public, we sent an email to our supporters that raised in one day twice as much online just from Maryland residents as our opponents had raised in the whole month, or at least as they had reported raising in the month.
Well, that seems very fishy to me that anybody would be able to hold back. You know, if I was running for Congress and I raised money in advance of, say, the June 30th fundraising deadline, any money raised by me before that deadline would have to be reported.
Sure. You know, the rules are a little bit different at the state level here in Maryland. And, of course, the big question here is what organizations like NOM are going to be doing in the background and how they're going to direct money into the state at the last moment in order to make those big TV ad buys that you were talking about. You know,
well, and you know they've got those wealthy backers. I've seen reports that say that there's four people that donate almost all of the money that NOM uses. So, Josh, I want to thank you for joining me and talking to me about the effort to get marriage equality finally legal in Maryland. Folks out there, if you want to contribute to the campaign or get involved, you can go to MarylandersForMarriageEquality.org. Follow them on Twitter at MD4Equality. Josh, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Carl.
All righty. This is the Tom Hartman Program. When we come back, we're going to be talking about marriage equality in the state of Maine. It could be the first state to pass marriage equality by initiative.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ever wanted to get married outside of Kennebunkport, where the Bushes live, in a gay civil marriage? You could have an opportunity. Up next.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program with guest host Carl Frisch. Connect with him on Twitter at Carl Frisch and visit carlfrisch.com for more information.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. I am Carl Frisch. It is 20 after. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com or on Twitter at Carl Frisch. Joining me now to talk about the fight for marriage equality in the great state of Maine is Matt McTee, who is the campaign manager of the effort up there. Hey, Matt, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
Doing well. I was just telling listeners before the break that Maine could be the first state in the union to pass marriage equality through the initiative system, something that's often been used to take rights away from LGBT people.
That is correct. And even if, we're hoping, obviously, we're very optimistic that that is going to be, we are going to be the first state. But even before that, we're already making history. We're the first state to actually bring a proactive citizens initiative to bring this fight, because we've had so much time over the last 3 years since 2009 when we
right.
came very close to passing it the first time. We've been able to keep up the work, so we actually were able to bring this sort of on our terms and play offense for a change. Normally in all these other states, we're always
sure.
playing defense.
Well, give us an update. How are things going in Maine?
Things are going extremely well. We've seen polling consistently in the mid-50s, and one poll that even had us as high as 58% support for marriage. We're very optimistic about that. But the bigger thing that we're really excited about is, you know, I alluded to the time factor. You know, we came so close in 2009, within 30,000 votes of upholding the law that was passed there. Fell a little bit short, but then just kept the work going right up, you know, right up until now. And we actually just last week had our 100,000th conversation, one-on-one conversation.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so it's sort of the centerpiece of our campaign because we have a lot more time to do the type of grassroots field advocacy that we know is important for changing hearts and minds. We've been doing this one-on-one campaign, having these personal conversations.
So for people that don't know, I mean, marriage equality was passed by the legislature in Maine, signed by the governor, and then repealed by initiative.
Exactly.
And since that time, you all have been having these one-on-one conversations about the importance of marriage equality.
Yeah, and going out, I mean, in a state like Maine, where we have only roughly a million voters to begin with, you know, 100,000 conversations is not insignificant. You know, we've talked to more than 10.
Well, no, imagine the ripple effect.
Exactly. And those are just the conversations that we can track, that we can know for sure we actually had, and we know who the voter is. You know, we know most of those people then go out and talk to their family, talk to their friends. We train people to have those types of one-on-one conversations with the people in their lives.
What impact do you see the president's decision to come out in support of marriage equality having in Maine?
You know, as far as an impact on the actual electorate, you know, it's probably going to be relatively minimal. What we found over the last, you know, 2.5 to 3 years of doing this type of work, this is just such a personal issue that it's people can only come to it on their own terms. They have to come to it on a personal level. So it's not that they're going to change their mind because of, you know, somebody, even someone as prominent as the president coming out for marriage. That said, it always is great to see, you know, really prominent officials, public leaders, politicians, anyone who can voice their support and actually walk people through their own journey and talk about their evolution. And sort of what the president said is exactly what we hear from people all the time when we're out going door to door. People say, you know, we're talking about this at our table, we're talking about this with our kids, we hear about it from our neighbors, and we just realize that, you know, it's, you know, we understand that the same reasons that, you know, my wife and I wanted to get married are the same reasons that same-sex couples in Maine want to get married.
Well, before I ask you the next question, I want to let people know they can find you online at MainersUnited.org. That's MainersUnited.org. You're also on Twitter at MainersUnited. I'm interested, during these conversations, do you ever encounter people that had been initially against marriage equality back when they put it on the ballot the first time, they switched their minds?
Yeah, in fact, I mean, we run into that quite a bit. And since, because we were out getting, you know, this time around, we actually brought it ourselves and had to go out and gather signatures to bring this citizens initiative to the ballot. And we heard this time and time again from people when we were out gathering those signatures, you know, I didn't vote with you in 2009, or I stayed home, or I was really unsure about this, but then they met somebody or they had a personal conversation with somebody who helped them understand, you know, why marriage matters for all loving, committed couples. And in fact, we have a press conference next week with a handful of prominent Republicans in the state, one of whom is a legislator who actually voted against it in 2009 when it was in the legislature and was opposed to it at the time, and is now very actively supporting the campaign.
That's fantastic. And do you anticipate that those wonderful folks at the National Organization for Marriage are going to get involved at the same level that they did before?
They already, well, same level, we don't know, but they're already involved. Frank Schubert, and I'm sure many of your listeners are probably familiar, he's the guy that's the mastermind behind almost every one of the anti-marriage campaigns that have taken place around the country over the last several years. And he's, you know, his consulting firm, his new firm.
He's become very wealthy hurting LGBT people, that's for sure.
Well, his new firm is already working with the Christian Civic League of Maine and the National Organization for Marriage. They filed the paperwork to take out, you know, to create a PAC so that they can run the opposition campaign against us. And we're certainly...
Are they going to actually file their contributors' names and occupations this time?
Well, they're still involved. You're obviously very familiar with the lawsuit that is still pending. They are refusing still to disclose their donors, and they've actually sued the Maine State Ethics Department, the nonpartisan State Ethics Division, and, you know, to keep from having to disclose their donors.
And what kind of a risk does that, you know, that's an awfully fishy way. I mean, usually you hear from conservatives that they don't want any limits, but, you know, the way that they'll compromise is by reporting names. Obviously, there's this movement afoot on the right to claim victimhood when they're actually perpetrating the bullying. What impact do you think it's had in Maine that they're hiding who's funding the efforts?
You know, I mean, I think most Mainers, when they hear about it, and it's, you know, we have to understand, of course, this isn't at the forefront of most, you know, just average Mainers' minds, you know, but when they hear about it and they sort of hear these stories about this out-of-state organization coming in and trying to influence an election, but then refusing to disclose their donors and suing the State Ethics Commission, that is a little fishy, and I think most voters in Maine do get a little skeptical about that and want to know, like most people want to know. We're not threatening to do anything.
Right.
But we're not, you know, planning to, like, pick it outside their houses or anything. We just want to, you know, we just think that they should play by the same rules that
absolutely
we do and that everybody else does.
Matt, I want to thank you for joining us. Matt McTee, he's the campaign manager for Mainers United for Marriage. More on them at MainersUnited.org. Go and give them a few bucks.
Thanks.
Have a good one. We'll be back in just a minute with the state of Minnesota.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're talking about Minnesota's battle for marriage equality.
Love and marriage, they go together like a horse and carriage.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom and talking about marriage equality all this hour. I'm Carl Frisch, 34 after. You know, we've already spoken with folks out in Washington where they're fighting to preserve legislation signed by the governor granting marriage equality. And we've talked to the folks up in Maine who are fighting to create marriage equality in their state by passing a marriage equality initiative. And now we turn to the state of Minnesota, which is kind of an old school fight if you think about it. They are fighting the right-wingers to stop from amending the state constitution to ban something in Minnesota that is already illegal, and that is marriage equality. And joining us to talk about Minnesota and the fight that they face is Kate Brickman. She's the press secretary for Minnesotans United for All Families. Kate, thanks for joining me.
No, thanks, Carl. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So how are things going in Minnesota?
Well, you know, as you said, we are in a little bit of a different situation here in Minnesota. I really wish that we were in a different fight, but here in Minnesota right now, the legislature did vote last May to take existing law, which already says that same-sex couples cannot get married, and put that into the Constitution, so permanently shutting down the possibility of the freedom to marry for the future. And so we have put together this really incredible, broad, diverse coalition with Minnesotans United for All Families, more than 500, actually, organizations, everything from community and business leaders, faith, labor, progressive and nonpartisan organizations, communities of color, and pretty much just a really broad range of people who are all working with us to defeat the amendment to make sure that we can leave open the possibility to talk about marriage in our state.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about marriage equality all this hour. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8466. Kate, are the attacks already happening? I know I've seen quite a bit in terms of web stuff from the marriage equality haters up there, the NOM folks. How intense is it getting? I know the new fundraising numbers came out, and it looks like you all are doing pretty well comparatively. Intense is it?
Yeah, I mean, we're really unique here in that we've already been going at this for more than a year from the time that this started until, and we still have about 4 months to go. And there's definitely a lot of, there's already a lot being said, both sides. We're really just trying to stay focused on the message that we're trying to send out there. And it's about having real conversations with people about, you know, the gay and lesbian people in our lives and how this amendment hurts them. And, you know, I think all of us can agree that at the end of the day, love is about, marriage is about love and commitment and responsibility. And the more that we have conversations across our state about this, the more and more we're seeing people coming to the conclusion that they're going to vote no. And so it's really incredible to see that. As you mentioned, we did have our fundraising numbers come out not too long ago, and so far our campaign has raised $4.6 million, and our
opposition
has raised $1.3 million. I think what's most incredible about that is of those donors, 19,000 individual donors contributed to that $4.6 million. hundreds, you know, 19,000 people. And of that, 93% of those were Minnesota people. And so we had this incredible list of 19,000 people who, you know, not only said they were voting no, but made a monetary contribution. And the other side showed 26 names.
Well, that's kind of their thing. I mean, if you look at the National Organization for Marriage, their most of their money came from like four people. I want to get a call in here, Kate, if you don't mind. Let's take Jerry in Augusta, Georgia. Hey, Jerry.
Good afternoon.
Hey, Jerry. What's on your mind?
Listen, well, my point is I resent the fact that your movement, whoever it is, is trying to redefine the term marriage.
From
there
what?
There are those of us that firmly believe...
Jerry, I'm going to let you talk, but I... Jerry, hang on.
Well, it's,
Jerry,
it's
hang on.
Definition is
Jerry,
between a man
Jerry,
and a woman.
Jerry, who made that definition?
It's been that way for about 2,000 years.
That's not true, now, Jerry. That's not
is
true.
True.
No,
it
the
is true.
The definition of marriage... Jerry, let me talk for a second. I'll let you talk. The definition of marriage has evolved greatly over the last 2,000 years. 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, people, as recently as 500 years, in, prior to maybe the 16, 1700s, people, men, had multiple wives, you know, and you only have to go back 50 years, 60 years, to when women were basically chattel in relationships in the United States, you know, when women were basically, you know, set up on arranged marriages and part of property, and they couldn't have their own credit cards or their own bank accounts because they were property of the man. So the definition of marriage has evolved greatly over the last 2,000 years. Don't get me started with this idea that it's some 2,000-year definition of one man and one woman. It's just not true.
It is true. There's nothing that you can show me in regard.
How about the Bible, Jerry?
Well, that's what I'm referring back to.
You seriously think
was given to us between a man and a woman?
What, with Adam and Eve?
Marriage.
With Adam and Eve? Jerry, are you there?
I'm listening.
Are you talking about Adam and Eve?
Make your point.
I'm asking you if you're talking about Adam and Eve.
I'm not talking about Adam and Eve specifically. Later on, the definition of marriage was defined as between a man and a woman.
Okay, cite for me what chapter and verse. It's not in the Bible, Jerry. It's just not.
I don't have the Bible.
Because it's not, Jerry, if you had the Bible, it doesn't exist. I want to know, and I'm just going to ask you a very frank question. Why don't you think gay people should be able to be married?
They can have their civil unions, and that's what you lobbied for, and you got it. But the definition
No,
of marriage,
what do you mean we got it?
Between a man and a woman.
Jerry, there's no civil unions in Georgia.
Well, that's because in every state where they've had the opportunity to vote this, it's been voted out.
So, Jerry, again, why don't you want gay people to be married?
Because marriage is defined as that between man
why?
And woman.
You can tell me. You can tell me that you don't think gay people are good enough to be married. I know that's what you think. That's why you're having trouble speaking logically, because you know that you're not supposed to say it out loud.
You're putting words in my mouth.
Then why don't you think gay people are good enough to be married?
This isn't a castigation against gay people.
Then why can't they have the same thing that you do?
They can have the same thing that I do, but...
No, they can't.
You cannot change the definition of marriage.
So they can have a different drinking fountain is what you're saying. So they should just drink out of a different drinking fountain?
That's your analogy, not mine.
You're the one that's saying they can have the same thing. I'm saying it's separate and it's different.
I'm talking about the definition of marriage.
No, you're not, sir.
Between a man and a woman.
Sir, when did you choose a vagina over a penis?
I don't understand where you're going with that now.
My point is, if the shoe was on the other foot, I'd be happy to let you get married. But you're so locked in your ideology that you can't see 2 feet in front of your feet.
Now you're attacking me personally. My whole goal in this is to stand up for the definition of marriage.
But you're not explaining to me why you're standing up for it. Just because it's 2,000 years old. Slavery is thousands of years old, and it's in the Bible. Why don't you stand up for that?
Why do you want to redefine it?
Because I think any two people who love each other and want to be committed to each other and want to have the responsibility of marriage should be able to have it. That sounds a lot better than, because it's a definition that's old. All right, Jerry.
I stand firm with the belief that marriage.
You stand on nothing, Jerry. Like you're standing on a piece of glass over a skyscraper. You're going to fall, and you know what? You're going to be left on the wrong side of history. Have a good one, Jerry. All right. I think we've got Kate back. Is that right? Kate, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Sorry you had to hear all that. Apparently
okay.
Something about, Webster's Merriam Dictionary or something. So things are going well, I take it, in Minnesota.
Yeah, things are going really well. And, you know, I think actually some of the things that were brought up there are the reasons that it's going well here. I mean, in Minnesota, just like all across the state, people know that, you know, the definition of marriage is about love and commitment and responsibility.
Right.
And, you know, no one wants to change marriage. In fact, there are just thousands of people who want to join marriage, who say, marriage is so incredible. We want to join this. And I think that's what we're seeing here in Minnesota is the people who are saying, you know, please don't single us out and exclude us from something, so great that we should celebrate in society.
It's something that strengthens a community, really.
Oh, I mean, marriage is good for society, and it holds people accountable to one another. And the more that we can, you know, encourage people to be in loving and committed marriages, the better. I've been married to my husband for almost 5 years, and I certainly wouldn't trade my marriage in for a civil union. I think gay and lesbian people want to get married for the same reasons as everyone else, for love and commitment.
Well, that's
and
the thing. So it's always disappointing when somebody mentions civil unions, because usually they don't know that there are no civil unions for most of this country. And second, they're not the same thing. There are thousands of rights that married people get that even people in civil unions don't have access to.
Sure. It really comes down to, you know, like when you ask someone why they got married, the first thing they say is, well, because I was in love.
Right.
And, you know, when you ask someone, well, why do you think gay and lesbian people want to get married? Why do you think same-sex couples want to get married? And they say, well, for rights and benefits. And they definitely want those things, and they definitely deserve those things. But at the end of the day, it's about being able to commit yourself to, you know, the person you love. And I think most of us, it's hard to imagine to be told that it's illegal to marry the person you love. I just can't imagine being told.
I think that's the great thing. These conversations that people are having across the country really, they end up putting people in the shoes of an LGBT person, and that's what's going to make the change here. Kate Brickman from Minnesotans United for All Families, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Carl.
You can get more from them at mnunited.org. Go sign up, give them a few dollars, help them out. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, we'll be talking about marriage equality in Washington State. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman closing out the show with you. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-TOM. I'm Carl Frisch, filling in for Tom this afternoon. It's been a delight working with Tom's great team here, and it's always fun to chat with you, his loyal listeners and viewers. Let's take Doug in Denver. Hey, Dougie Denver.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, I completely disagree with gay marriage or civil unions, whatever it is that you want to call it. First of all, God has said in his word that homosexuality is an abomination. When God created Adam and Eve.
Doug?
Yes.
We're going to have a conversation. I'm not going to let you do a monologue, but we're going to have a conversation. Okay, so Doug said that it's an abomination. God said that it was an abomination. Didn't he also say that shellfish and mixed fabrics were an abomination?
He did.
So why aren't you against Red Lobster?
Well, because in the dispensation at the time that was given, that was in the Old Testament. In the New Testament,
so is God Leviticus in reference. So is Leviticus in reference to man lying with a man as he does with a woman. That's in the Old Testament as well.
Exactly, and he continued that on into the New Testament.
How?
New Testament says God said in the New Testament that homosexuality is an abomination.
Where?
In the book of Romans.
What did he say?
Well, if I could look it up for you right now, but I'm on my cell phone, I would tell you.
Okay, now here's the kicker. Here's the kicker question. Why should your religion trump our Constitution and other people's religion?
Because you're trumping on my religious freedoms.
No, I'm not. If you, if, I wouldn't make you marry people. I wouldn't make your church marry people. That doesn't.
So here's my question then. Do married people pay less in taxes than non-married people?
Sure. But you know
okay,
what?
Then if you allow homosexuals to marry, then you're causing them to pay less in taxes, which means that me, as someone who believes what God has said, you're forcing me to pay more taxes.
But Catholics have
allowed them to pay less taxes.
Doug, are you, Catholics, the Pope is against the war, but Catholics still have to pay for taxes that pay the war.
I don't understand that logic.
Obviously you don't. I mean, it's the same logic you just used. You're basically saying that because gay people would get tax dispensations for being married, that it impacts you and your faith because you'd be picking up some slack there and it disagrees with your faith. Well, Catholics oppose the war. Hang on a second. I'm explaining the problem that you didn't get. The Catholic Church opposed the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, lots of other things. And yet, Catholics still had to pay taxes for it. It's not discriminating on them. Everybody chips into the same pot.
Our federal government has already agreed that they will not spend federal tax dollars to fund abortion. And the main reason they will not spend federal tax dollars to fund abortion is because you're taking my money and using it for something that is against my religious belief.
Yeah, but I would argue that a lot of people share your belief, but not on religious grounds. So it's monolithic at that point.
Whether religious grounds or not, the fact is,
Doug, nobody's. I'm not going to make you.
Not spend,
Doug, when did you decide that you preferred having sex with women over men?
God created men and women.
Right,
that
but
way.
When you obviously
Adam and Eve.
But you have free choice, right? You have the ability to determine what you like and don't like, and if it doesn't relate with your religion, then you turn away from it, right?
I absolutely do.
Okay, so
I turn
when
away
you were
from
having
it
Doug,
the way
Doug,
God created me.
Doug, let me finish. When you were having sexual attractions towards men and towards women, what made you choose women was the Bible, right?
Well, first of all,
or were you not having
sexual attractions toward men because God did not create man to have attractions?
Right, but you understand that certain
how he created Adam,
Doug,
he brought,
Doug,
he
hush,
told Adam he
Doug,
needed a,
hush. Okay, here's a question I've always had about Adam and Eve. They only had sons. Where did the sons' wives come from?
They had sons and they had other children.
So the sons married their sisters?
Absolutely.
Is that traditional marriage?
That is not traditional marriage at all. It doesn't say that they married them.
So are Cain and Abel in hell, or are Adam and Eve's children in hell for fornicating with their sisters?
No, because what sends somebody to hell is the fact that they don't believe what God says.
So God says it's okay.
The Bible says Abraham believed God, and that was counted to him for righteousness.
So let me ask you this question, Doug.
Been through faith in what God says.
Doug, let me ask you this question. If a majority of the people in this country did not believe in your religious doctrine, because there are Christians that don't believe the same things you do, you'll grant that, yes?
Absolutely.
Okay. Should they be able to put their beliefs down your throat?
I don't understand your question.
See, that's funny because that's what you're trying to do. I mean, you would have it. I mean, my marriage to a man in Washington, D.C., I'm not married, but if I was married to a man, it would have no impact on you. It wouldn't make your church recognize my marriage. What it basically says is that the government's not going to decide who can marry and who can't marry between two people. It doesn't say that the church has to have any part in it. In the same way that your church doesn't have to marry a Jew to a Mormon. So I just have trouble if it's not because of something that is animus towards gay people. I have trouble realizing where you're coming from.
Same argument of whether or not the federal government should spend my tax dollars on abortion.
It's the same. So
the same exact argument. I don't want my tax dollars spent to recognize something that God has said is an abomination.
But they already.
And my tax dollars would be spent.
Do you think Jews are going to heaven?
I think Jews are going to heaven provided they believe
in Jesus.
In Jesus Christ.
What about Mormons?
Jesus Christ was
Do you think Mormons are going to heaven?
if they believe that Jesus Christ is the only way.
But if they don't, then you shouldn't have to pay for their marriages through your taxes. God bless America, because I can live in a world with crazy people like that. Thanks a lot, Doug. Bless you, and hopefully you'll find a church that actually tells you something that's true. This has been the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom all afternoon. It's been a delight. I've really enjoyed working with Tom's team yet again, and the show will be back. I don't know if it's on tomorrow. I think, nope, they're on vacation tomorrow, but they'll be back soon with more great talk. Check me out online, carlfrisch.com. You can also find me on Twitter, at Carl Frisch, or on Facebook. Just look me up, and we can continue the conversation. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.